Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network and New Books in History. Today, we're on the podcast channel, New Books in Eastern European Studies. And I'm Steven Siegel, your host, coming back to you again today from San Diego, California. We're pleased today to welcome Professor Anita Kurame, who is an associate professor of history at Bryn Mawr College. She received her doctorate degree in history from Rutgers, and specializes in modern European history with an emphasis on East Central Europe. Professor Kurame's main research interests include the history of sexuality, women's and gender history, conservatism and the politics of the far right, human rights, and the history of sports. Today we'll be talking with her about her new book called Queer Budapest, 1873 to 1961. Published by the University of Chicago Press in 2020. This is a book that examines the history of Hungarian politics of non-normative sexualities from the late 19th century to the present. Professor Kurame is an expert and has published articles, in addition to the book, on Hungarian gay and lesbian history in journals such as Sexualities and Eastern European Politics and Societies. Thanks for joining us today on the podcast, Anita.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So I love this book in a lot of different ways. As someone who's also worked with the University of Chicago Press and knows about the late editor Doug Mitchell and all the wonderful books that he had and sponsored, I want to start with a question which I sometimes ask but don't always ask, and that's about you, because I know you have had an unusual career and came into academe in let's say atypical ways. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
Sure, I would be happy to. So I grew up in Hungary, still under state socialism, where the state kind of facilitated people's sporting activities, and if you were good at something, that they provided you with in my case, a racket and a team. And I came to tennis actually at the time when my parents were out in here in the US, but the state wouldn't let the whole family to come. So actually I was apart from my parents, but in return, I started playing tennis, and it turned out I was pretty good at it. So that was at age 8. And by the time I was 14, I was on the national team, and then I became a professional tennis player. But with a twist that I had an Australian coach in Australia, so I started traveling pretty extensively and actually stopped going to school. So I didn't have the usual experience of high school and the dramas that I hear many Americans had in high school. But so I traveled with tennis, and I stayed at the time, the kind of common practice that you would stay with family. So I had the opportunity to live and extensively, for instance, in Japan, where I would, in the countryside, actually stay with a Japanese family. And then subsequently, I lived in Australia. And I was just blown away by the gender dynamics of different cultures. coming from Eastern Europe, where, you know, there was formal gender equality, but not a whole lot of gender equality, for instance, in the household. Then I was, you know, transported to Japan, where I was just floored by what I perceived the lack of respect towards women and the deference that women had to show towards men. And I went to Australia, and my host family, you know, men were doing dishes and cooked. And so I became interested in politics of gender early on. And then I arrived to UC Berkeley with a sports scholarship for tennis. I had the opportunity to start thinking about these issues through the lens of history and, you know, sociology. So I became interested in politics of gender early on. And then also had to do with, in a huge part, of course, had to deal with my own sexuality, discovering that I was different, that I was gay, but a whole, you know, another part of on kind of my intellectual development. I'm still very interested in terms of queerness in sports, but I table that for now. That's something that I'm going to think about it in perhaps in my next project. But in terms of thinking about hunger specifically, you know, growing up, the only time I saw or heard about homosexuality, I still vividly remember, I must have been 7, and on state television, there was these two homosexual adolescents who basically had their faces covered in a way to protect their identity. And it was just a horrible experience at the time. And also think, you know, in terms of the pathologization and medicalization of homosexuality, there was not a lot of information for me to draw on. Conversely, when I actually started thinking about, could there be homosexuals in the past? Could there be, where are the homosexuals in Hungary? I started looking, and there was absolutely nothing in even popular or academic literature. And then one day I was literally walking down in Budapest, the picture is Budapest, and across from the National Gallery, there are these antique bookstores. And that's something that, you know, in Europe you have, I think, still abundance of, as opposed to, I think, in the US, a lot of things are moving online. But so I went into the store and totally by accident picked up this book that had a very interesting title. It was called Tragedies of Sexual Life. And I started reading through the book, and it's literally in 5 pages into this physician's description of Budapest. It basically goes to say, Budapest has the first homosexual registry in the world. There are over 5,000 registered homosexuals in Budapest alone. And I was just like, wait a second, what is going on? So this was, you know, this was a moment of discovery where, as already a PhD student in history, not definitely knowing what I wanted to write on, other than it had to be something about gender politics in East Central Europe, this was such an amazing jam that I felt like my fate was sealed. I knew this is the route that I wanted to go down and think about the history of homosexuality and homosexuals in Hungary.
Yeah, there's so much that I want to ask you about. And I really don't know where to start after that, between Australia and Japan and the US and Budapest. But one of the fascinating parts I find in your LGBTQ history is this idea that a lot of people have the notion that somehow LGBTQ history begins much later in the 1970s and 1980s. But as you say, you scoured these publications and archives. I remember in Budapest walking down Andrássy út and going to Akadémia Kiadó and looking for maps for my own research project. So it must have been an absolute revelation for you to start going through the sources. Could you tell us and our listeners about the sources that you found, including this fascinating registry?
Yes. So I think, you know, part of the reason and difficulties of the so-called recovering LGBTQ or like, you know, the queer past is precisely has to do with the sources and the politics of the archives, right? Like so much of particularly even in, you know, in Europe, everything, it's the bureaucracy is pretty big. And in terms of archives, there's like a logic and an established way of doing preservation, right? And so, of course, queer lives and queer memories do not make it into official archives unless they are pathologized and medicalized and criminalized, which in case I found, of course, that sex between men was indeed criminalized in Hungary since 1878 till 1961. But women, sex between women and sexual acts between women was not. Hence, again, in terms of talking about sources, it was much more difficult to find sources on lesbian and queer women in the past. And again, it was a great revelation. And thanks to basically the digitalization of historical newspapers that I came about, a huge lesbian scandal of the 1920s between these, you know, one of the greatest Hungarian writers, Cecile Tormai, and an aristocratic woman who were actually sued and basically put on trial by the husband of the aristocratic woman, Eduardina Pallavicini, alleging that the two women were sexually involved. So again, in terms of sources, this was one of those another aha moment where I found a treasure that otherwise would have been really, really difficult to find, since queer voices don't tend to leave and had not left a lot of sources behind. So in terms of my sources, more generally, I went on the more institutional route, since male homosexual acts were criminalized. I actually hand by hand went through the indexes of the Budapest Criminal Court. It took me 6 months to basically find the top every single legal case where paragraph 241 or 242, those were the paragraphs that criminalized male homosexual acts. Were basically there were charges, and then I tried to find the documents explaining and detailing the cases. And unfortunately, many of these documents were destroyed in World War II and were not fully there. But there was one of the ways in which I could still do my due diligence and really try to recreate the legal experience of men who had sex with men or who were alleged having sex with men. In addition, I relied on two of the most famous investigative journalists of the early 20th century who published a number of books. They had a Sinful Budapest series was really truly a bestsellers of the day, and who actually went not only slumming, so to speak, in the really fast growing Budapest, and you know documented the so-called the underworld, but specifically speaking, they actually wrote a short book on what they call the Nights of Sick Love that's how they referred to homosexual men.
Sorry, could we talk about them, Cornel Tabari and Vladimir Sekely, a little bit? So who were they, and how did they come to be so famous in their investigation?
So they both were journalists. In addition, Vladimir Sekely was also worked for the police and actually led the PR section of the police, which is again a novel institution. This is again the turn of the 20th century. the you know, the penny press is booming, more people are reading. So the police also recognizes that they are in need of educating the public, but also portraying a more favorable picture of the police themselves. And Vladimir Seker was in charge of that. And Dabory was just an already acclaimed journalist who was very interested in social issues. And so they teamed up and using the police resources and, you know, the tips that the police could get them, they actually covered various crimes, but with the eye towards profit, right? And they quickly discovered that sex sells papers, and thinking about, you know, prostitutes, thinking about homosexuals were not only important in an era where that people try to understand the burgeoning sexual world of Budapest and these large capitals, but also that they actually could profit from writing about these issues.
Yeah, and Seke was a member of the police, wasn't he? Or he at least he was very closely affiliated with the police. So how did that work?
So again, it was a different. It's from a historical point of view, it was a different era where the police and journalists could foresee and understand that they have a common cause, which is to make, in this case, Budapest a more livable and safer city. So that meant that actually Seke, again, was employed as a former journalist, but employed by the police in order to work on the image of the police, to educate the public, but also provide a more more fact-based picture of the crime statistics and crime scene of Budapest, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I'd like actually to ask from there about the organization of your book into particular time frames or eras. So for those of our listeners who might not know a lot about the temporality or let's say the signposts of Hungarian history, how did you decide to organize and arrange the book into periods?
I mean, as you know, historians tend to do, chronology plays an important role, and in fact, it is the most important organizing factor in the sense that Hungary went through a tumultuous history in terms of being part of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy until the end of World War One, then having the second, you know, communist republic after the Soviet Union, and then of course we have an interwar authoritarian regime until World War II, following with again a fascist regime that was as just brief as the communist dictatorship after World War One. But then of course Hungary experiences along with the rest of the Eastern Bloc becomes part of the Soviet sphere of influence and has a communist party until 1989. So I kept the political framing of the book as a guiding principle, but my goal was basically to show that if you look at these distinct political regimes, if you look at these regimes through the lens of sexuality, you actually get a very different picture than you would normally get in political narratives, which of course stress drastic different policies and just, you know, different nature of the different nature of these regimes and periods.
Yeah. So I love how you draw these very uncanny parallels between the eras and the representation of queerness. There, I think, are a lot of surprises. I got this impression, especially in reading about let's say, official policy toward homosexuality, the stigmatization and the criminalization and the medicalization of it. So in comparing the different governments, let's say the Béla Kun regime or the Hungarian Soviet Republic with, let's say, the Horthy regime, what were some of the surprising findings that you had as you went through the popular history, social history, official archives, and so on?
Yes, I mean, so it's each of the chapters, I think, offered some sort of paradox in a sense that we have our assumptions about, say, a liberal regime in, you know, that predates the Béla Kun regime, where these investigative journalists operate. The liberal regime sets up the first homosexual registry, it's claimed, in Europe, right? So in and of itself, so the paradox was there. Basically, in order to become a modern metropolis, the police wanted to follow existing models of crime registry, and they actually created also a registry for homosexuals, which was a very novel concept of thinking about basically an identity based on who you were sleeping with, right, at the turn of the century as a category. So in this sense, in terms of the Béla Kun regime, the communist, you know, the Soviet Republic in 1919 was also a paradox in a sense that they actually decriminalized homosexuality, so which was incredibly early if you're thinking about in the decriminalization history of homosexual acts in the world. At the same time, they also believed that rather than as a medical pathology, they, by embracing psychoanalysis and psychology as these novel ways of thinking about crime, they believed that homosexuality was in effect transcendent. So it was just, it had to do with basically a trauma from your past. And if you rehabilitated these, what they called, you know, basically homosexuals or sexual abnormals, you would arrive to a perfectly healthy heterosexual society. So again, the paradox it was for me is that they truly believed in truly believing the transformation of people into socialist citizens or communist citizens. They also believed that homosexuality would just be eradicated.
Yeah.
Meaning that essentially, that would be giving absolutely no space for actual homosexual identity in their imagined society, right?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but before we move to the authoritarian interwar regime under Horthy, the chapter that you have on quote unquote rehabilitating sexual abnormals in the Hungarian Soviet Republic, could you tell us what sort of sources you're relying on there? Because I'm fascinated by your part on the experimental criminal department. What was that? And how did that, at least in its understanding of justice and psychoanalysis, define homosexuality?
Yeah, so just very quickly, circling back to sources, and I am and forever in debt to the archivist who I met in this case at the Budapest Archives, that's the Budapest City Archives, who basically having me spent, you know, 6 months going through the judicial records, they were like, okay, you might want to take a look at these records. And in many other archives, yeah, as historians know, you need the graces of the archivist to actually aware of what is there behind the indexes that you get to see. So in short, they gave me this basically file on the experimental criminology department of 1919. And so my exposure and, my basically source base comes from a file that was kept on the criminology department's daily activities. I mean, it was all about their existence, their establishment, and some of their cases that they took on during the brief life of, you know, 133 days of communist dictatorship. And then in augmenting that, then I also looked through the communist basically the communist newspapers and the official communist newspaper at the time that I had to go through every you know every day, and I read those, and I also found you know crucial importance of relating to basically the decriminalization of homosexuality and also to the kind of the conceptual framing of this experimental criminology department and more generally the communist justice for the future.
And would you describe the Hungarian communists' attitude toward sex differently from the Bolsheviks? I mean, because there was this Bolshevik code, right, on marriage and the family and guardianship. I think it was 1918 or 1919. I think it was 19. Mm-hmm. So how, I mean, how did it work in Budapest during those 133 days? Was it different? Because there was a lot of, you know, psychoanalysis that comes out of the Central European tradition, right?
Right. I would say that, well, you know, and again, there's been Dan Healy, there's been a lot of books written on the Soviet experiment and, you know, in the 20s, kind of more positive framing of sex and sexuality. I mean, it's important that 133 days is not a long time. So we can't really think about implementation of ideas, but in terms of ideas, I would think about the Hungarian case slightly different, precisely because I think they had a longer history and of psychoanalysis and also a willingness on the political front. So on the Communist Party's front to truly embrace psychoanalysis, not just to tolerate it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I guess beyond that, you know, you mentioned the scandal of one of Hungary's most famous writers. There are all sorts of double standards which apply to gay men and to lesbians differently. So could you talk a little bit about that, especially as the scandals break out? I mean, I see more scandals after the Kun regime and into the interwar period, but maybe correct me if I'm wrong.
Scandals have been part of, and I think, again, in terms of going back to, you know, the mass press and early 20th century, I think scandals became, and particularly around sex, became a way to talk about sex, but also sell papers. But in terms of the largest scandals, so scandals were kind of part of, I think, particularly urban histories of Central Europe and Budapest at this time. But the largest scandal that I discovered had to do with two women in the 20s, which was, of course, already the Horthy regime, which, of course, was, you know, a total rejection of the liberal and communist regimes that came before. So it was something that really rocked the public, because it was also had to do with women, which and respectable women, which you know, they were used to reading about men in terms of sexual scandals and who they seen as irrespectable women. But in this case, both of the kind of the people involved were all respectable.
Right. And who were they again? So Cecile Tormai
and Eduardina Pavlovicini, which the two, literally two of the leaders of the new conservative women's movements, who, according to some analysis, you know, had close to a million members by the late 1920s. So these were incredibly visible public figures who also, you know, stood for the conservative regime, which advocated, of course, strong family values, what we would consider, you know, absolutely heteronormative sexual behavior. And so, you know, the hypocrisy couldn't have been larger, and the stakes couldn't have been higher, both for the regimes and for these women themselves, even if Torma herself, who was also the editor of the most well-known, actually intellectual journal of the new conservative right, was single, right? But
right.
She still was, the voice of the conservative regime on matters of women and family.
Yeah. And I mean, could you draw some larger comparisons with, say, Vienna or Berlin or Paris in this period? Because one of your larger arguments is also about modernity. And this is a chapter in Hungarian modernity. So I'm thinking more specifically about cases of divorce or libel in the 1920s. I mean, how does it kind of play out, not just in Budapest, but also in a larger European?
I think, you know, there are absolutely European trends that, that you know, since the late, most places now, increasingly marriage is secular, right? And so you can actually file for divorce, which was, you know, it's only became the case in the late 19th century where you have a more separation of state and church. But importantly, even if, say, in Budapest, right, it's a conservative government versus Berlin and Vienna, you know, at least in the 20s, are in the opposite camp. They have the Weimar Republic and also Social Democrats, right, in power in Vienna. With that said, following World War One, in each of these places, the idea of the family as a normalizing agent and the importance of producing more babies for your future nation,
right.
After the carnage of World War One is imperative. But it's, of course, in Hungary, it's also an added pressure with this Christian conservative. So it's you know, in a sense, it's your mission in life is also sanctified by God. So it's even more of a scandal when you have these women who stand and propagate this idea, which is, let's not kid ourselves, it remains an idea. Women always worked, and even aristocratic women after World War One and middle class women continue to have public roles. But nevertheless, and in fact, Tormai, the one of the figures, pioneers women entering university in larger numbers. So I think, you know, it's we have to differentiate between the rhetoric of this, you know, idea of women's place that is at home and child rearing and education versus actually the reality that women were gaining ground in the professional world regardless. But nevertheless, most people prescribe to these ideas at least. And then you have at the same time this massive scandal that rocks this image of these women who seen as incredibly hypocritical in the eyes of many by essentially allegedly having a sexual relationship while one of them is still married.
Yeah. And was it, would you say, possible to have a public same-sex relationship? It's different for queer men. It's different for lesbians, but was it possible in interwar Hungary under the Horthy regime? How active was the police, let's say, in going after people public in the 1920s?
I think, again, like one of the important findings of my research had to do with the fact that, of course, you had the rhetoric, and then you had also actual laws, and the Horthy regime did pass very serious laws that basically pushed prostitution underground, female prostitution, and also really policed public morality, so, you know, public sexual acts in public to a much greater degree than any of the regimes prior. But what is important, and what I found that in actuality, thanks to the culture, which again believed that men were inherently sexual and respectable, women had no sexual drive, disproportionately focused on the public policing of women. And
interesting. Yeah.
And in turn, I argue and I saw that actually men not only could carry on with their sexual relations with various women and not fulfilling this idea of, you know, the monogamous sexual relationship that was prescribed by the regime, but also in terms of particularly queer men, as long as they had the privilege, and it was a privilege to have access to the private sphere, the Huerta regime basically closed their eyes towards homosexual men who basically had consensual relationships at home.
Mm. And did that apply to prostitutes as well? Because there was also a kind of registry of, male prostitutes.
So the other important idea is that, of course, the Huerta regime differentiated between what I call respectful and homosexuals, who again were otherwise full members of the community, who could have homosexual relations in, again, consensual homosexual relations in private, versus men who either sold themselves in public, or men who basically had sex with men in public, thereby challenging the public morality. So the Huerta regime put extra resources to eradicate the growing market of male homosexual prostitution, which after World War I really became an established scene of Budapest, along with all the other major cities in Europe. But the Huerta regime stepped up its prosecution of male prostitution at the same time as also facilitated what I would argue the growth of a private homosexual scene, particularly for men.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, I've asked you a lot of questions about the Huerta regime, largely because it has experienced this, to my mind, strange rehabilitation, not just since Orban in 2010, but Fidesz and Jobbik love this period. I write about the Trianon treaty in my own work on geography and cartography. And I think it makes it an uneasy alliance and an unlikely alliance, as you argue. Could you tell us a little bit about the transition into both fascism with its eugenics and communism up until the end of your book in 1961, when we finally get the decriminalization of homosexuality? So what happens in Hungary in the history of queer Budapest under both fascism?
So this tolerance that actually describes the Huerta regime in terms of particularly certain male sexual practices, and again an excuse for tolerating male sexuality, is in many ways upheld by the conservatives, who just have this belief that as long as we don't talk about sex and particularly homosexuality in large forums, it's not going to spread, right? They all at this point believe sexuality is fluid, and they really much worry that if we talk about homosexuality, it could affect young men, particularly who are susceptible to ideas, right? And so there's also a constant threat of masculinity is a fragile being, and we need to make sure that it's regarded in the right way. At the same time, of course, they're also very good at looking away if there are minor infractions that happen, such as, you know, men having sex with men, as something that it's not constitutional. It doesn't define you as a homosexual if you have sex with men, particularly after, of course, the experience of World War I, which was understood as a largely normative space that actually men experienced and seen homosexual acts in to the extent that was unheard and unseen in history before. But so moving forward, it has to do with really the Nazi influence and also the, you know, eugenic ideas being incorporated with to a much greater degree once Hungary enters the war in 1941. And it has to do with this idea that homosexuality now can actually, you know, be really deteriorating in terms of the armed forces, as well as it can be seen as a biological, essentially, weapon that could destroy the nation from within. And so these ideas, which of course you could see that had been circulating in eugenics circles prior, even in Hungary, but you see it in, of course, being adapted by the Nazis by the mid-30s, become reality when really Nazi-friendly government officials come to be in really important forces. And so you see how you have a hardening of the police and the authorities in terms of their treatment of homosexuals on the registry and also people who they prosecute. And in fact, there's even a talk among the Minister of Interior to setting up a homosexual registry, just like Hungary sets up a battalion for first Jewish forced laborers. They are thinking of essentially setting up sexual registry, but of course the army absolutely not.
Yeah, no, that's frightening. I mean, it really is. If you think about it, it's a census. I mean, it's to keep track of people, right?
Yes, and this is also another history of showing how the homosexual registry, which we don't have a copy of anymore, we don't know what happened to it, had a life of its own, and each political regime could use it for very different purposes. So just going forward, you have the Aircross regime, which is, of course, again, a very brief regime that never gets to enact laws that it passes in terms of homosexuality, but it's actually in its new become a new family law. It makes both male female homosexuality a criminal act, and moreover, it actually punishes male homosexuality when it's caught with castration, and it's just, you know,
wow, yeah.
Takes it to the extreme in terms of thinking about the biologization of citizenship, right? This idea that your essentially sexual act is somehow a reflection of your biological health, which is in turn a reflection of the nation's health.
Yeah.
And so it truly wants to eradicate homosexuality from the, you know, future of Hungarian state, which never becomes, of course, a reality.
I think you do a great job, Anita, if I may say so, covering these kind of ideological overlaps through the chapters and in a very surprising way. One of my questions was, why did the decriminalization happen in 1961? So what was it that led to that point, or what was it that led to a shift out of the 1950s? Because there was a great insistence on gender equality and no fault divorce and those sorts of things. So why was it in 1961 that this final decriminalization happened? And I guess the follow up question to that is, how complete was it?
Right. So in terms of, you know, the initial communist regime and the setup in, you know, 1948, they similarly to Bela Kun's, you know, 1919 Hungarian Soviet Republic, I argue, and it's documented, they truly believed they wanted to transform society, which is, I think, we don't give them credit for that. We of course, it came with an incredibly bloody, you know, it led to incredibly bloody results and we have to understand and acknowledge that. But in terms of gender equality, it goes to say that the communists believe that by truly enacting and legislating gender equality, they would transform society and create communist citizens where, you know, marriage would wither away. And they truly had these revolutionary ideas about how to transform society. Part of that was also this idea that homosexuality, not unlike in 1919, was something that was a condition and not an inherent condition. But they believed that, unlike in 1919, that homosexuality was now in many ways the enemy of socialism. That it was something that actually they had to eradicate in order to arrive to this socialist society. So they, again, unlike any of the regimes prior, by now had the means, they had the authority, they had the kind of bureaucracy with the registry, and they actually provided enough resources to the police that they could go after homosexuals in private as well as in public, and basically give them try them, and then they would hope that by punishing them they would shed their so to speak homosexual behaviors, right, and become a model citizen. And then I just wanted to say that.
Go ahead, please.
And so by 1960s it was clear that the kind of socialist society that they imagined was not going to happen. And this is, you know, in very much in line with the abandoning the true reforms of gender equality and
right.
the ideas that they initially harbored, that by basically medicalizing and pathologizing homosexuality as an innate condition that cannot be changed, they also could abandon both gender equality and this full transformation of society, including the transformation of homosexuals into model socialist citizens.
Yeah. And I guess from there, I'd like to ask about your big points, because one of the recurring themes I find in your book is about visibility and misremembrance or a failure to remember the queer past, which goes back a very long time. In the records and beyond that. So what would you say for our readers and listeners would be the big takeaway points from your past to the present today? And I am asking this as a veiled political question. It's not veiled enough, but it is, of course, under the Orbán regime and what has happened with their anti-gender politics and Central European University and such. So What would you say would be some of the lessons, if you will, or at least points for further consideration?
Well, I would just stress that in terms of reinserting and studying the history, you see that there was actually a really rich history that included coexistence for large parts of the past of different political regimes with queers. And that becomes important, of course, in the post-89 and the post-2010 moment when, of course, Fidesz gains supermajority. But in more generally, this idea that, of course, after 89, queerness explodes into the public, right? This idea that particularly in East Central Europe, the presence of pride, there's this idea that homosexuals arrive with the help of basically capitalism on the wings of liberal democracy. So this idea that
and
you had democracies that queers could exist, which of course, as in my book try to show, it's absolutely not true. And why it becomes important, however, is because particularly this very I would say dark this communist period in terms of the history of homosexuality, that the fact that At the same time, even post-decriminalization, you have an absolute pathologization of homosexuals. And at the same time, their utilization in the form of as secret agents, it creates a scenario where you don't have an acknowledgement of the history of homosexuals and their life under communism, both because, for instance, the homosexual registry still doesn't exist, and also in turn, the agents, the former homosexual agents, of course, they don't want to talk about their own past as a way of working for the Communist Party, right? So
yes, that's a great point. Yeah, there is
collective silence around the existence of essentially the past, queer past, that transcends political, again, political regimes for different reasons, but in most, but in terms of the communist era, it's particularly important because, again, they exploited homosexuals and their homosexuality and also incredibly pathologized them. At the same time, I would say in the West, you already have, the gay liberation movement. So you don't have that kind of visibility of homosexuals. And that allows Fidesz and, you know, conservative, these now increasingly religiously based arguments to be made that again, queers arrived with the secular liberal democracies and they would not be here otherwise. And if we just go back to this ideal world, and this goes to say, again, with the reincarnation of the Horthy regimes and interwar, again, Poland and Hungary, both as these Christian nations, then somehow queers would also disappear.
Yeah.
Which is just this argument that I like to, with historicizing the queer presence, like to refute.
Yeah, that is a major contribution to East Central European history and historiography. I think that point, certainly about thinking about the queer past, not just as a way of bringing 1989 and liberal democracy, but there's an illiberal history to it as well. So if you could recommend maybe a couple of other books on this topic and talk a little bit about your current interests and research, I think our listeners here at New Books Network would love to hear about this. I mean, the kind of research that you've done, honestly, in dealing with a registry that was hidden that you can't find is just spectacular. So maybe a couple of books you'd recommend, and then what you're going to be working on with the project.
Yeah. So two or three books I recommend in terms of getting to know the region, East Central of Europe, through the lens of sex, but also in doing so, realizing that it has a very particular space in the politics and just the history of sexualities in terms of not so much part of Western Europe, but also not so much perhaps part of the post-colonial world. So it's somewhere in between. I would absolutely recommend Katerina Liskova's recent book, Sexual Liberation, Socialist Cry, which truly shows this effort of sexologists in the Czech Republic and then subsequently Czechoslovakia in using sex as a way to reform society. And in many ways, how say your pro-sex arrived to Eastern Europe much earlier than to the West, even though it was subsequently rehearsed. And then also another book that I absolutely love, and I think it's a great read, is Josie McLellan's Love in the Time of Communism. And that's a book on East Germany, and again, the state's use of sex to basically make their citizens at least tolerate state socialism, if not love it. And this is something that if people are interested in why, for instance, Eastern Europeans love being naked and just in much freer, go right to lake and being nude and hence you know, coming to the US, running into difficulties, myself included.
Right.
So he had a very interesting and answer as of to why that is the case. And then lastly, I would probably also recommend Agnieszka Kościanska's Gender, Pleasure, and Violence book that is basically on Poland. And again, Polish sexologists' expertise and just the ways in which Poland, which has such an interesting history, of course, with, between the religion, solidarity, and the growing human rights movement in the 80s, thinks through sex and sexual expertise as a way to navigate these really difficult coexistent times between religion and the Communist Party. So these would be my three recommendations. And then in terms of my own work, I'm going to transition to, again, as I said earlier, to thinking about sex and sexuality in sports. And in particularly, I'm actually going to think about tennis as a...
Wow, as great.
And there are a number of ways in which I'm thinking about it, but it's still an early project, but stay tuned.
Yeah, no, right. Please write a memoir. I don't know. I mean, it's hard. Like, I've been listening to this wonderful podcast called The End of Sport on Twitter, which has been focusing. It's a very left perspective, but a really interesting one on athletics. And I think people would be fascinated in your story. But of course, it's hard to do between the academic histories and the personal history, right?
I think I have two books, but yes, I am thinking of, you know, I had the privilege of playing in a pretty high level and also seeing some very troubling and now, you know, understandable sexual politics in the locker rooms and on the court. So I think it's definitely worthy stories to tell.
I greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast today. Professor Anita Kurame is our guest. She is the Associate Professor of History at Bryn Mawr College, who just got tenure. Congratulations. And Professor Kurame is the author of a book we've been talking about today on new books in Eastern European Studies. It is called Queer Budapest, 1873 to 1961, published with the University of Chicago Press in 2020. I'm Steven Siegel, and I'm your host today. And thank you, Professor Kurame, for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.